Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Mike Peskin for Brian Lehrer on WNYC. In the wake of Sandy, hundreds of millions of gallons of raw and partly raw sewage flowed into New York and New Jersey, into the waterways. Perhaps you read about it in the New York Times in an article with this particularly gripping turn of phrase. In one low-lying neighborhood, a plume of feces and wastewater burst through the street like a geyser. Yick. The scribe behind that vivid description, Michael Schwartz, who's been reporting about the raw sewage problem this city and the region has been experiencing. Michael Schwartz joins me now. Hello. Michael, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. And thanks for joining me. And I will say, in a few minutes, we're also going to be joined by Commissioner Carter Strickland. He's with New York City's Department of Environmental Preservation. And Michael, you wrote about the city. You also wrote about some of the surrounding counties. And just give us, if you can, a bird's eye view of some of the biggest water treatment problems that were experienced because of the flooding of Sandy.
Well, there were a number of major plants in the region that were either knocked offline completely or knocked partially offline by the storm. And there's a number of reasons for this, mostly related to the storm surge, flooding generators or flooding engines that run the pumps that keep this sewage flowing through these plants. So in some cases, particularly the Bay Park plant, which I focused on, which is in Nassau County, you had water flooding into what is essentially a giant pit containing engines that drive pumps which provide coolant for other engines that run the sewage through the plants. And when you had these things stop, you had the sewage essentially which constantly flows through the these plants when they're up and running, essentially stop in the system and proceed to back up, either overflowing in some cases in low-lying areas coming up through the streets and into homes, or flowing into waterways, whether intentionally by plant workers trying to divert some of this stream into the waterways, mm-hmm. using emergency pumps, or basically just overflowing their pipes.
And Bay Park, that Nassau County plant, it serves 40% of Nassau County. It's in Hewlett Bay, which is pretty close to Queens. Is the flaw there that it's just old, it's serving, it was meant to serve a population far smaller, or was there actually a mistake in building some of the equipment too close to water so that it was susceptible to flooding?
Well, I think a lot of the experts that I was speaking to said this was in on many levels an unprecedented weather event here in New York, and certainly the Bay Park plant and many plants in the region were not constructed to handle the types of storm surges, the levels of storm surges that we saw during the hurricane. And so, a flaw or not, you know, the builders of these plants never anticipated seeing water levels that high. And now there's a dawning realization, not just among people who work in sewage, but in different other areas that we've seen, including mass transportation, including some of the hospitals we've seen in low-lying areas, that the infrastructure needs to be remodeled to anticipate these new conditions.
And, you know, it's a horrific thing to have raw sewage wash up on your lawn, which has happened. The solution was bolting manhole covers in areas where that's been known to happen. But what's the effect? Have they been monitoring bacteria? What has been noted in terms of what's in the sewage and what, you know, bad effects can occur because of untreated sewage in the waterways?
Well, you know, the extent extent of the damage is still, you know, even over a month since Hurricane Sandy, not known. I mean, there were other priorities initially, getting people's power back on, making sure everyone had a place to stay. And now officials have begun to look at this. But especially in these low-lying areas, there was a neighborhood in East Rockaway, there was a neighborhood in Baldwin and Long Island where you had sewage actually flowing into homes, and this occurred elsewhere as well. And when the sewage mixes with wastewater, gets into homes, it gets into the drywall, it gets into the floorboards, and this can cause various diseases like hepatitis A, Giardia, Salmonella, basically the only option here in many cases is just to throw all this stuff out and start over, and that may include gutting your home, you know, down to its frame, down to a skeleton, and rebuilding or knocking the house down completely for those who want to be especially careful about this.
And you do report in Raritan Bay, the Hudson River, and waters around the Bay Park plant, which is that one in Hewlett we talked about. The EPA has detected dangerous levels of fecal coliform, which isn't to say that, you know, they've been saying to tear down those houses yet. But there has been some dangerous levels detected.
There has, and I mean, but most people will tell you though that even though, you know, this is a colossal amount of sewage that flowed into waterways, the natural flushing of these water systems will send most of this out into the ocean, because it is much of it is organic material, it'll simply break down. The question is how long, and this is something that needs to be monitored closely, especially as you approach the warmer months when people start venturing out into the water more frequently.
Let's bring on the commissioner for the New York City's Department of Environmental Protection. He's Carter Strickland. Hello, Mr. Strickland.
Hello, how are you?
Good. So give us some idea of the effect of Sandy, because, you know, yes, it seems horrible to say and to witness untreated sewage released into, say, New York Harbor. But this actually happens all the time, right, after a heavy rain. So how different was Sandy?
Well, you're right, and you know, one thing is that our plants, wastewater treatment plants, have to be located on the shoreline because that's where they discharge. So, in many ways, there's going to be a certain level of risk that has to be managed. So, for Sandy, we estimate throughout the whole storm that we in New York City discharge about 500 million gallons. To put that in perspective, that's about twice what was discharged during the North River fire that we had a year and a half ago. But it does dissipate. So the bacteria and the pathogens that we worry about will die after, you know, 3 to 5 days, depending on the temperature of the water. So they don't persist forever. And I do want to say that in terms of getting into, you know, drywall and the like, any water is a problem and it will encourage mold, but it's not going to be because of necessarily pathogens in the sewage.
Right, but if this untreated sewage gets into a home, that won't dissipate.
It will. I mean, the bacteria, you know, their organisms, they will die. The good news is that we were able to recover very quickly, and I think that's the story, at least about the New York City plants, is that we had two plants that lost the ability to treat wastewater in the storm, but eight plants provided limited treatment. Most of our plants were able to provide full or almost full treatment capacity, and within 5 days we were treating 99% of the sewage, and then 100% just a few days later. And so we've been studying and taking samples in throughout the water body over the last month, and just on Friday we're able to list the advisory that we put in place as a precaution a few days after the storm. And just today, actually this morning, Westchester lifted its advisory for the waters in the Hudson River off of Westchester County. So the region is coming back.
How many treatment plants does the city have?
We have 14 treatment plants, so they're spread throughout the city. And you might expect that the most effective treatment plant that we had was a Rockaway plant. It's our smallest plant, services the peninsula, and like the rest of the peninsula, was completely overrun by water. And as the New York Times did point out, the most vulnerable part of the plants is the electrical service. So
right.
the things that can be done to make plants work in these flood zones are things like raising electrical equipment. And we were able to survive by we did a lot of sandbagging. We did a lot of, you know, preventive shutting down of some of the substations that we maintain. And that's part of the $10 billion we've spent on our wastewater system just in the last decade.
Of the 14 plants, how many went offline for at least a time during Sandy?
Well, we had, as I mentioned, we had two plants that lost the ability to treat wastewater. That was our Rockaway and North River plant at some point during the storm, and eight plants had compromised treatment. So we had four plants that maintained full or nearly full capacity.
And is so 10 partially offline, maybe got some of them back right away. Is that about what you expected, or did it surprise you?
No, I mean, we reacted fairly well. I mean, actually thought I was pleasantly surprised that, you know, the damage was as limited as possible. We knew that Rockaway would, you know, was going to be very heavily affected. And we had a lot of contractor and other resources brought to bear. We did a lot of pump arounds to make sure we could get back on the treatment. The other plant that was really in harm's way was on Staten Island outside of Great Kills Harbor, our, what we call our Oakwood Beach plant. And that plant was one that was redesigned in the late 70s, raised, you know, 11 feet or so above where the prior footprint of the plant. And we were able to maintain shelter in place, even though it was surrounded completely by water, and keep it operating. And that action alone at that plant prevented some 80 million gallons of sewage from being released. It was treated, and it's a great story.
If the water treatment plants, sorry, the sewage treatment plants have to be on the water, and if the water levels are rising, or at least we're more susceptible to storm surges than we ever thought before, are there solutions out there? Can we look to, I don't know, what the Netherlands does, what other areas who've experienced this and live knowing that they're in a vulnerable spot? Are there solutions that we could grab from throughout the world, or, you know, the top prominent thinkers here in America?
Sure. I mean, look, there are pumps, for example, that are, you know, function underwater, the submersible pumps. There are electrical equipment and control equipment can be, you know, raised above expected surge zones. So there are a lot of, you know, just moving equipment that can happen to make plants more resilient. And I think you're going to see that happen. We actually had a study underway, which ironically enough is going to be completed in February, looking at a few of our plants that will give us very detailed information about where we have to locate our equipment. So that's great, because certainly we're going to put that in place right away and make sure that we can have our plants operate during these kind of storms.
And Michael Schwartz of the New York Times, we could play a little Meet the Press if you care to. I'm sure you have Carter Strickland, could get him on the phone whenever you want. But is there a question for our audience that you'd like to ask him?
I'd love to go more into the Staten Island plant, it seems that this is kind of a shining example in all of this of what needs to be done, and I'm curious, you know, whether it's just as easy as that. You know, the governor has said that it's going to take about $1.1 billion to get the sewer infrastructure back online after Hurricane Sandy, and then it's going to take some investments to make these improvements, raising electrical equipment. I mean, does Staten Island serve as a model, do you think, for what can be done to keep these plants running in these types of storms?
Well, certainly if you're going to completely rebuild a plant as we did in the late 70s there, it makes sense to raise it up. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's a lot of money invested in plants, and I think as you pointed out in your story, they have to keep operating all the time. So it's like repairing a 747 as it's flying through the air, which is one reason why it's so expensive to deal with these plants, especially when you've got space-constrained areas, plants, as we do in New York City. So we can't build a second plant and then decommission the first one. We just have a limited footprint, so we have to upgrade the plant as it's treating all the sewage that New Yorkers create. So that's that's the reason it cost us $10 billion over the last decade to upgrade these plants. And we don't want to strand those investments. So I think you're looking at a lot of small ball investments that just make sense as plants are upgraded. If there's extensive damage at a plant, which we don't have, but might be the case elsewhere, then it does raise the question of whether, a wholesale upgrade is necessary and appropriate. Certainly easier to do wholesale renovations if you have the space and would have to do it anyways because of extensive damage.
And Commissioner, we just heard Michael Schwartz there talk about the $1.1 billion that Governor Cuomo estimates, talking about repairs for treatment plants. Is there a sense in the sewage treatment community, and please invite me to that convention, but is there a sense that you're just going to have to get a lot more funding, that there's no way around this other than to put a lot of money towards this infrastructure problem?
Well, this is an example of a development that's been happening over the last few decades. It used to be, when the Clean Water Act was first passed in the early 70s, it was accompanied by a massive federal grant program. And in the late 80s, that was shifted over to what was deemed by the federal government to be a financially sustainable model, which was block grants to states. And that goes into what are called state revolving fund loans, and that gets loaned out at very low interest rates to municipalities. But it's just debt that has to be paid back ultimately. So it's really the ratepayers across the country that are paid. There's no, unlike transportation or other infrastructure investment programs, the federal government pays very little. So, for example, I mentioned that just on the wastewater side, $10 billion we spent over the last 10 years. That's, we spend an equivalent amount on the drinking water side. Less than 2% has come from federal grants, and largely in the form of the stimulus bill. So on an ongoing basis, it's really the ratepayers who have to own up to making these investments. That doesn't have to be the case. That financing model could change, but that's the way it is now.
Carter Strickland, New York City Department of Environmental Protection Commissioner, thank you. And Michael Schwartz, who's been covering this story for the New York Times, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So our first two segments were about the morass in Washington and sewage. How about a story that doesn't make you feel dirty afterwards? We'll be talking with a groundbreaking program out of Venezuela, El Sistema, the transformative power of music. Stay with us.